This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Friday, April 15th of 2022. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, the latest UN climate report says political polarization is one of the biggest barriers to crafting solutions to the climate crisis. We'll hear from two congressmen reaching across the partisan divide. We'll also have a student-produced report on what a just transition to clean energy implies. After that, we will visit an exhibit on racism and classroom spaces. And finally, we'll have our regular Friday feature, .org. At 8:30, Connections comes your way. Duncan and Lisa Graves will discuss society's Clarence Thomas crisis and opportunity. As always, the phone lines will be open and your calls welcome. Then at 9:30, Meredith Carson will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead, but first, these local and regional headlines with KGNU's Jack Armstrong.
State lawmakers passed Thursday a $36.4 billion spending plan for the upcoming fiscal year. Although the Joint Budget Committee did not honor all the spending wishes by lawmakers, both chambers ultimately passed the budget, also known as the Long Bill, mostly by party line votes. The Denver Gazette reports lawmakers in each chamber initially added amendments to the spending plan. A House amendment sought to expand funding for an Office of Public Guardianship pilot program in two rural districts. The committee also cut Senate proposals to a tune of about $503 million to the Department of Education. Governor Jared Polis has 10 days to act on the spending plan. A former Douglas County School District Superintendent Corey Wise has filed complaints with the Colorado Civil Rights Division and the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission this week. He alleges the Douglas County School District and its four recently elected board members unlawfully fired him. The discrimination complaints say the school board fired Wise for implementing a mask mandate and for developing district equity policy. According to the Denver Post, the filing alleges that because Wise advocated for students and staff in protected classes under civil rights laws and was terminated because of that advocacy, his firing is retaliatory and a violation of civil rights laws. After voters elected a conservative majority to the school board last November, the new majority quickly worked to lift the district's mask mandate, which Wise worked to uphold as part of a successful lawsuit against the mask-adverse and newly formed Douglas County Health Department. Wise's complaints also alleges the new board removed all mention of diversity in its new equity resolution, as the equity policy previously implemented by Wise received backlash among conservatives, who equated the policy to critical race theory. Shortly after his termination last February, the board's conservative majority said that they fired Wise because they did not feel supported. According to the Denver Post, neither the school district nor the members named in the filing have responded to requests for comment. The Immigration Council, Immigrant Justice Idaho, and Immigration Equality filed a complaint with the Department of Homeland Security alleging two guards at the Aurora Immigration and Customs Enforcement Detention Facility committed racial discrimination, retaliation, and excessive use of force against two black immigrants and other detainees at the facility. The organizations say two guards, identified as Alvarez and Perry, engage in egregious behavior against the two detainees, who have been identified by the pseudonyms James and Musa, along with demanding the termination of any staff that used excessive force or committed civil or constitutional violations. The complaint also requests GEO Group, the company contracted by ICE to operate the facility, to institute corrective measures. The policy attorney for American Immigration Council told the Colorado Sun the two detainees, whose nationalities have not been revealed, are seeking asylum or protection from torture in their home countries. The policy attorney also told the Colorado Sun the complaint could spark a Department of Homeland Security investigation or even facilities closure. According to the Colorado Sun, the immigrant rights organizations filed the complaint in late March and have not ruled out filing a lawsuit. Boulder County Public Health has updated their COVID-19 data webpage. KGNU's Emma Martinez has more.
Boulder County Public Health recently updated the county's COVID-19 data webpage, which now includes live dashboards that will be updated every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. The webpage provides access to the county's total positive COVID cases and cumulative deaths. the Boulder County Public Health conducted new calculations that removed confusing data from the webpage. For example, the Omicron surge in January and February had to be carefully reviewed and assigned to their appropriate dates. The recent changes were created to provide friendly and accurate information to all users by focusing firmly on the population of Boulder to avoid misleading information.
The State Board of Education signaled Thursday it was open to restoring partial authority to the beleaguered Adams 14 School District. According to the Denver Gazette, the board gave the district 6 more weeks to develop a plan outlining a partnership with partial manager that will assist the district in a turnaround of effort. A state review panel recommended the board reorganize the district or close or consolidate the district's schools. The School Board of Education still potentially opt for closure or consolidation of the district's schools if district leaders do not submit a sufficient plan by May 11th. Adams 14 unanimously voted to end its contract with its previous full oversight manager earlier this year, amongst tensions between it and its management company. The Denver Gazette reports the State Board of Education became dissuaded in urging another full oversight company after the school district and state officials said there were no companies that showed interest in performing complete oversight. Today's weather includes sunny skies with highs in the upper 60s and breezy winds that could gust as high as 25 to 28 miles an hour. Tonight will be mostly clear for Fort Collins and partly cloudy for Denver and Boulder. Tonight's temps will be in the low 30s. The current temperature in Boulder is 50 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Jack Armstrong.
You're listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon. The most recent report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change indicates partisanship is one of the biggest barriers to crafting solutions to the crisis resulting from climate change. CU Boulder's Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences hosted a discussion yesterday between two congressional representatives who have reached across the partisan aisle on climate policy, Colorado Democrat Joe Neguse and Republican John Curtis of Utah. One issue they agreed needed greater understanding from ideological opposites is how the transition away from fossil fuels affects a sector of jobs that has created a degree of social mobility for people from working class backgrounds. Representative John Curtis says in practice, fossil fuels and the economy that depends on them will likely be around for quite some time.
Fossil fuels have a role in a green future, particularly for a very, very long time. And so part of our demonization needs to be to say, look, there are dirtier fuels than other fuels. U.S. natural gas burns 40% cleaner than Russian natural gas. We could reduce more greenhouse gas emissions by replacing Russian natural gas with U.S. natural gas than any other thing I know. So let's have those conversations and be upfront about, is there a role for fossil fuels in reducing worldwide greenhouse gas emissions? And make them part of that conversation and not just start with automatic premise that, look, we got to kill all these jobs and the livelihoods of the people that do these. We also need to be talking about carbon sequestration and direct air capture. And I think people want to at least have those conversations instead of this automatic assumption that we have to kill all fossil fuels immediately.
Those who want faster transitions to clean energy must also understand and advocate for labor protections and decent pay standards, says Representative Joe Neguse.
We can't make the same mistakes that we made with respect to the transition away from coal. And you see that in coal communities across the country and here in Colorado, where we talk about just transition, but we weren't prepared to make the necessary investments to effectuate that. And if you go visit, just as John said, Craig, Colorado, and Nucla, and different communities in our state, I think you will find incredibly hardworking citizens of our state that care deeply about their future and our collective future. And we have to be prepared, I think, to also hold to account the other industries that are developing and that will obviously be the large driver for our energy sources into the future so that they employ and implement the same labor standards that have existed in other industries that are, you know, more conventional, traditional fossil fuels.
For more on what this so-called just transition implies, we go to a report by CU Environmental Studies students Allison Ohringer and Amalia Kamley in our collaborative series, The Brink.
Renewable energy transition comes with growing pains, especially in industries reluctant to adapt or in areas dependent on fossil fuel extraction.
Still have two kids in high school with one almost ready to graduate college and another in between working right now.
Colin Pace has been a coal miner for 16 years at Kremer Coal Operation in Wyoming. He says a rapid transition away from coal would have a real and immediate impact on his family.
Way would hurt. I still owe on my family home. We still have car loans, everything like that. And I am the main breadwinner, per se.
With IPCC goals of cutting emissions by 2050, state lawmakers have begun to close down plants. Since 2012, coal jobs have already been cut 50%.
Coal is not the enemy. It's the pollution. It's the carbon emissions, right? It's the emissions that cause climate change. That's really what we're fighting against.
Suzanne Teagan, the assistant director at the Center for New Energy Economy at Colorado State University, worked with state legislators and utility companies. Teagan says it's important to strike a balance in a way that doesn't harm workers, but rather gives them options.
We need the workers and their families to be made whole, right? They've been powering our economy for decades. And so we need to be grateful to them and certainly not see them as the enemy. How are we going to bridge that between now and the new job?
Teagan says a just transition must provide the proper training and all the benefits of the job these miners would be leaving. However, winning over these workers is key. That would include convincing longtime coal miners like Pace that green alternatives are actually viable.
There's things I think maybe need to change, but the way I think our country's going about it, we just want to flip a switch and go to renewables, and they're not reliable. Solar doesn't work with no sun. Wind doesn't work without any wind. If we had something more reliable, maybe I would jump on board a little bit.
He is not the only coal miner or homeowner with hesitations about the reliability of renewables. That is why Suzanne Teagan says diversity in green energy supply is so crucial.
I think there is a misconception that, you know, when the wind's not blowing, how do you get power, right? Well, the wind is blowing somewhere. There are states like Iowa that get like 50% of their power from wind energy, wind electricity. You know, we know how to do this.
Another argument putting the brakes on the transition to renewable energy is cost. But according to a report by the International Renewable Energy Agency, without subsidies, renewable energy is cheaper than coal. Teagan's work at the Center for New Energy Economy includes coming up with strategies to make the transition from coal to renewables fair and equitable. That means confronting a legacy of environmental racism.
Coal plants have been placed traditionally in low-income neighborhoods, in neighborhoods where there are people of color. They have proportionally more asthma. They have more lung disease, right? And so we can't do that anymore. I mean, when we put in a new power plant, no matter what kind of power plant it is, we have to think about those repercussions and think about who is living there.
Energy is changing quickly, and workers in industries that refuse to adapt may be left behind. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the U.S. already uses more renewables than coal, and that transition is feasible. A just transition requires that workers like Colin Pace have fair job opportunities when that change finally comes. And strategists like Suzanne Teagan are trying to make this happen. For KGN News The Brink Series, I'm Allison Ohringer with Amalia Comlett in Boulder.
CU Boulder Environmental Design Gallery put up an exhibit on race and space in the classroom. It explores race conditions and spatial operations of whiteness. CU student Carlos Carvajal spoke about how the architecture of the campus classrooms perpetuates racialized experiences.
How are classrooms racist?
Yeah, so we posed the questions, how are classrooms racist? And thinking about a classroom setting within a racialized society, right, it's something that's embedded whether we're conscious of it or not. So in this exhibit, we kind of aim to explore the relationships between the experience of BIPOC people in an academic setting and of course the architecture of the space itself. So we explore ideas such as a desirability of a seat in contrast to the proximity of your professor, right? And this idea that, okay, if a student wants to become invisible and blend in and avoid that visibility of the instructor, you know, why is it that way? Why do classrooms in their architectural form allow that to happen? And how can we reform that?
How many students are in this research project?
There were three of us, three students in the environmental design program, led by Professor Shaheen Rudbari. Yes, this is the culmination of a year's worth of research.
How can a space be safe for a person of color, a BIPOC student, or unsafe? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. In terms of safety or lack thereof, we talk a lot about kind of on campus, the institutionalized blueprint of a classroom setting, right? These sterile white walls, much like the space we're in right now. And thinking about more, like, is that actually the best way to design a space? And what we found is that these white sterile spaces actually lead to a decrease in comfort, especially for students of color.
Let's take one of these pictures that we have, and if you can explain to me the drawing in itself, that would be great.
Sure,
so
yeah,
let's go there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, take me there.
Yeah, and so that's not news to anybody in this building.
Explain to us what we are seeing.
Really, the issue for us was, since we're tackling such complex ideas, maybe things that are more subjective and feeling emotional-based, really trying to figure out what the best way to represent that is. So what we're looking at right here is the architectural representation of the space, right? We're looking at the plan view, and we're following the path of one student as he crosses those thresholds. Even things as simple as doors, right, actually create a subconscious barrier for some students. And we're showing how one might navigate that space. And then we're also showing the placement, his final landing point, and how his destination is related to being hidden from that perspective, from the professor's gaze. Yeah, and then as we move over here, you know, here we really are taking the same kind of architectural drawing, but then applying this grid that explores the relationship between visibility and comfort, as well as proximity to the instructor. And what we found in the research is that the most desirable spaces for a person of color that does not want to be seen is, you know, tucked away in these back corners. And really the question that we're asking is, why is that? And how is architecture as a whole contributing to that? And how can we as designers and aspiring architects change that?
You know, when I see these drawings, what comes to my mind is the same distribution of a court.
Yes.
And you have that judge looking at you, and when you are called, you need to be in front of everybody saying that you are guilty or not. Is this something that is related to this kind of design?
I think that's an amazing point. And the parallels between, like you said, the courthouse, for example, they do exist. For example, the way that we've interpreted this space with the professor at the head of the classroom, right, inherently puts him at a position of power, much like the judge in a courtroom. So really exploring how we can reimagine this, how we can make maybe a more equitable space so that there's less of a hierarchy between instructor and student. But I really do like the parallels you drew to the courtroom. I had not thought of that previously.
You're graduating, I'm guessing, in architecture.
Yes.
That's very cool. So how are you going to use this knowledge, this research, in your future work?
For me, it's almost embedded in who I am at this point. I applied a lot of my personal experience into this particular research project, but also it's something that bleeds into everything I work on as a designer or architect. And yeah, I plan on finding a space that allows me to continue pursuing that kind of work and that kind of design, and seeing what I can do with that.
Why is it important to provide a safe space, especially for BIPOC students and people in general?
I think it's more important now than ever. I think for most of history, we've designed for the 99% rather than the 1%. And really, if we can focus on that, creating a more equitable space for everybody, then that's how we can truly use design and architecture to make a difference culturally and racially.
this exhibit is here at the university, but can you explain how can people find this exhibition and how long is it going to be here for people to participate? Because it seems like there's also a way of interacting with the display.
We are here in the Environmental Design Building. I very much implore you to come check this out in person. It'll be up for 10 more days because you're exactly right. This is something that is meant to be experienced face-to-face with the wall. But if that's something that can happen in terms of seeing it in person, the rest of the team and I will make sure that we make that available to anybody that's interested.
Is there also like a website that people can go and look at the research done and the display?
Yes. I'll bring you over here. So this project is through the Descent X Design Program. So if you want to look up Descent X, DISSENTXDESIGN, and that will be all of the information provided on that website.
Can you just close it by talking to me about the importance of the mentor and the teacher that has brought you to come to this conclusion of spaces that could be racist?
It would be Dr. Shaheen Rudbari here at Environmental Design. He teaches ranges from lectures to studios. This project in particular was a research assistantship. You know, he holds these almost every year or two, so great opportunity to explore, you know, the implications and the relationships of race and space. It was really eye-opening, even as a student of color myself. You know, a lot of this retaining and interpretation of space happens subconsciously and isn't something that I was truly aware of until, you know, Shaheen brought it up and asked us to explore these concepts. Maybe more work in the future can help students of color kind of understand that and strive to making a safer and better place.
What's your name again, and what's your minor or major that you are graduating?
Yeah, my name is Carlos Carvajal, graduating the Environmental Design Program with an emphasis in architecture.
I hope that you get a lot of people coming here into this exhibit. It's super cool. For KGNU, I am Rosanna Longo-Better.
Welcome to .org, KGNU's weekly look at local nonprofits.
Hi, this is Chris Schultz with KGNU.org. I'm here with Stephen Lefevre with Teens Inc. Stephen, why don't you tell us a little bit about your organization and what you guys do?
Our mission is really to empower youth and their families to make healthy choices and thrive. And we were founded in 1997 when a group of teens really wanted to create a space for themselves. So they worked with the community to raise $1 million and build a 6,800 square foot facility right on the banks of Barker Reservoir in Nederland. And since then, we now have run a high school for youth who desire non-traditional setting. We do youth employment programs. We have outdoor leadership programs. And then we're open every day after school for youth to come and hang out for free. We've also kind of expanded over the years by opening a preschool. One of the programs we're most excited about here is our Teamworks, and that is a collaboration with Lincoln Hills, which is the first African-American resort kind of west of the Mississippi. We hire youth from more urban areas within the Front Range, mainly Denver Metro, and then we pair them with rural youth throughout the Front Range. So Idaho Springs, Conifer, and they come together and work 40 hours a week during the summer. And it's a really amazing way to bring people together from different backgrounds to work on projects, mostly on public lands throughout the Front Range. And through that, the youth really form great connections and they do really meaningful conservation related work. All of our programs have a heavy emphasis on environmental stewardship and also kind of challenging oneself through outdoor adventure. Just because that's such a great way to practice kind of the skills that we're really trying to work with young people to develop, such as healthy risk-taking, resiliency, conflict resolution. All of those can be really taught in challenges that come about with being outside. Through that, we've been able to recognize needs within the community. One example being Teens Inc. runs a soccer program called Peak to Peak Soccer. Other examples of that is we run a parent education program. We get lots of calls wondering how a teen center in Nederland has been able to survive for 25 years and not just survive, but really provide an integral service to the entire community. Our programs span and range further than Nederland and have a really great impact throughout the whole Front Range. You know, to learn more about Teens Inc., our website, teensinc.org, we do have a running race, but there's a 5K, 10K, and half marathon, which much of it runs through trails within the Nederland area. And that will happen the second weekend in September. That's a great, great opportunity to support Teens Inc.
You've been listening to .org, KGNU's weekly look at local nonprofits. For more .orgs or for more information on this episode, visit news.kgnu.org. And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Alexis Kenyon. Special thanks to Stacey Johnson, Jack Armstrong, Emma Martinez, Shannon Young, Amalia Kumley, Allison O'Ringer, Rosanna Longo-Better, and Chris Schultz for all of their help this week and today. Stay tuned for Connections just after this news update from the BBC.